You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When Leslie Jordan arrived in Hollywood in 1982, he had big dreams, a tiny suitcase, and $1,200 sewn into his underpants. He had a lot stacked against him in a town that demands physical perfection and archetypal masculinity from its male performers. Jordan was 4'11", still is, with bright red, now silver hair, and a deeply ingrained Tennessee accent that wasn't going anywhere. He was also, as he writes in his new memoir, the gayest man he knew. Still, Jordan has worked steadily as a writer and character actor, winning an Emmy in 2006 for playing Beverly Leslie, the nemesis of Megan Mullally's Karen in Will and Grace. If his name does not ring a bell, it's likely his voice will when you hear it in a moment. Leslie, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You write in the book that your mom did her best to make it safe for you to be who you really were as a kid. What did she do for you?
Well, my mother and my grandmother, I think, took one look at this little boy and thought, oh, he's going to need some help. And they circled the wagons, as only true Southern women can do, and they created this sort of wonderful secret garden where it was okay for little boys to play with dolls. It was okay for little boys to read. I liked Trixie Belton and Nancy Drew instead of those rambunctious Hardy Boys. It was okay for little boys to sew doll clothes and make potholders. I was very artistic. And they encouraged me in that area, but I knew my dad was a career army man. My dad was, and this is the 1950s, you know, early 60s in the hills of Tennessee. As my spiritual advisor said to me once, I love this, he was doing the best he could with the light he had to see with.
What a great expression.
But my dad adored me, but I innately sort of knew that this little secret garden, we couldn't let Dad in on it, you know. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of grow up with this sense that you're ashamed of what you are or who you are, and yet you don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. Now, my journey was my father was killed in a plane crash when I was 11, and I adored my daddy, and 11 is a terrible time for a boy to lose his father anyway, but I sort of knew to the core of my being that he went to his grave a little ashamed to have this a son like me, and, you know, you don't even know what like me is.
Mm-hmm. The sorrow of that, though, Leslie, is that it you think if your dad had a normal lifespan, he might have had more light, even in Chattanooga, Tennessee, to see you in a different way.
Or I have to tell you, my mother, on my 53rd birthday, which was two Tuesdays ago.
Happy birthday.
Casually, thank you, began to regale me with this story. My mouth fell open. I wanted to scream at her. I've been in therapy for years. My mother said, this was a wonderful story. She said, they took me to a wedding. I'm probably 3 years old, and I could not get my eyes off the bride. And so my cousin and I started playing Bright and Goon. I was the bride, and I would make my cousin Karen be the groom and put something on my head, and we'd walk up and down. Well, when Santa Claus asked me what I wanted for Christmas, I said a bright doll. Mm-hmm. I wanted a bright doll, and oh, that's all I could talk about. So Christmas Eve, I'm going on and on. I can't wait. I'm going to get my bright doll. I'm going to get my bright doll. Well, my mom finally said to my dad, she said, Alan, you're going to explain it to him in the morning because I'm not. I don't know what to do here. This would have been 1958. My daddy went out in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and scoured the town to find his three-year-old son, the most beautiful bride doll. And my mother said the next morning when I saw it, I squatted in the floor and wet myself. I was that excited. But I thought, you know what? Who knew? I mean, all those years, it's so amazing when you think about things that we carry from childhood. Mm-hmm. that is just excess baggage. You know, it's just so unnecessary. But I just saw it in a whole different light. He was doing the best he could with the light he had to see with. He just wanted me to be happy. But what's the biggest fear that a man of his generation could have, that their son was going to turn out homosexual? And I'm in the front yard twirling a baton. I mean, there's very little doubt.
Yeah, the football team did not interest you.
Well, it's funny you bring that up. My mom tells me that he took me once to. My mother was a champion baton twirler. You know, aren't they all in Tennessee? Yeah. But my mother was in high school, and my dad took me to this football game, and he's, you know, trying to explain, you know, son, this is the offense. And my dad used to call me son as if he was in deep pain. It was sort of, like, son. But he was saying, this is the offense and this is the defense, and trying to explain the game to me. And mother said, I sat there a minute, and then I pulled his sleeve, and I said, Daddy, when do the majorettes come out? Because that's what I loved, you know. I loved the halftime. I had no time for the actual game. I loved the festivities, you know.
Now, your dad was very handsome, and not a tall guy, but certainly within the range of normal, you know, for American men. You're 4'11". Did you spend most of your childhood thinking, well, I'm going to get to 5'4", 5'5". I just got to give it some time.
I never thought about my height ever.
Really?
I don't know if it was the way I was raised. I had amazing parents, you know. They told me on a daily basis I was special, I could achieve whatever I wanted, to the point of where I got in first grade, you know, and realized, well, I'm not that special, you know, I still have to abide by the rules. I do think that, of course, once you get to high school, I think if I had been heterosexual, it may have bothered me a little more with the whole dating thing. Mm-hmm. But I was sort of, you know, by the time I reached junior high, I was just kind of in a marijuana fog. So it didn't matter whether I was 6 feet or 4'11". And I don't remember ever worrying about that. You know, people ask me that a lot. You know, did that bother me growing up? But I don't remember that at all. I remember being thought of as a sissy bothered me a lot, you know, especially during dodgeball, you know, smear the queer.
You don't want to be the one
they're going to hit. I think that's how I learned to be funny, you know, because it was either tap dance or get creamed. So I learned to use. In fact, I have this fantasy. There's my 35th high school reunion. And they got my mother involved. I kept telling my mother, I didn't like him back then. Why do I want to go now? And she said, but Leslie, come on. You've been very successful, and they want to have you. And I said, okay, I'll come. But I thought, you know what? I want to find that one kid. There was this one kid that tormented me on the playground from first grade, you know, in a fairly small town, Chattanooga, first grade to 12th grade. We're with the same group. And this one kid just tormented me. And I want to find him, and I want to tell him, you know, because of you, I learned to be funny, because it's the way in which I kept the bullies at bay. I realized that very early, and I've had a very lucrative career being funny. So first of all, I want to thank you, but I'd also like to tell you to kiss my rich TV star butt, and then I'm going to leave.
Did you find him? Did he show up?
No, it's not till August. It's coming up.
Oh, no.
It's coming up.
I wonder if he'll be sorry, if he's thought about it. Not because you're famous, but thought, you know, because people grow up and mature and think, God, what an idiot I was.
I know. I asked around. I said, you know, have you seen that guy? And a friend of mine said, no, but I saw his brother. And I was walking through the Walmart, and there was a guy, you know, by the hot dog stand selling the hot dogs. And he yelled and said, hey, I went to school with you. And I thought, see, he hasn't even made it to greeter at the Walmart. You know, he's
working his way up.
Yeah. So who knows?
So you talked about being in a marijuana fog, and you write in the book very candidly about during the time it took you to figure out that it was okay to be gay and that you didn't have to hate yourself and you weren't going to burn in hell. You used drugs a lot for that purpose.
I figured out, you know, I'm sort of a product of the 60s, and I just figured out really early, you know, that 14 years old, I remember I came from a teetotaling family, Baptist, you know. Every time the church doors were open, we were there, which has been another, you know, part of my struggle. But the girl down the street, her parents drank, and we got into her 14 years old and got into her parents' liquor cabinet, and we didn't know. I mean, we had little scotch, little bourbon, little cream de menthe, just drank everything. And I can remember, like it was yesterday, all of a sudden, that horrible sort of – I was a very self-conscious kid, you know, and thought people were looking at me. And all of a sudden, I was adorable. You know, I was just – and the more I drank, the more adorable I became. And I figured out really early, and I think this is true of a lot of gay and lesbian people. We use drugs and alcohol to sort of combat that kind of inner shame or inner fear. And I just figured out, you know, it was a lot easier to be gay when I was a little loaded. So, you know, the 60s were just a lot of smoking pot and Boone's Farm apple wine. And then it rolled into the 70s and it was, you know, staggering around in discos, taking Quaaludes. I looked sort of like a rock and roll troll doll. I had all this hair. And then the 80s was making money and little cocaine. And then all of a sudden it's the 90s, you know. And here I am, just the party's up, the jig's up. But it was interesting. I got two DUIs in 1 year. And in my family, that's my father's mother, his sister, his favorite aunt, and his favorite cousin. When I was 4 years old, they were hit head-on by a drunk driver, and all four women were killed. And, you know, that event reverberated through our family for years. And, you know, just for me to drive and drink was just horrid, you know. But I did. I mean, I did. I just did. But so when I got sober, I had two DUIs in 1 year, and I thought the jig is up. I ended up in jail with Robert Downey Jr., which is another chapter in the book.
It's a very interesting story, actually.
But anyway, I'm 42 years old. All my medicine is taken away. And, of course, I've been living as an – you know, people say, Leslie, when did you come out? And I say, well, you know, one has to have been in. I sort of fell out of the womb, landed in my mother's high heels. But not out you know, within, it's people talk about gay pride and marching in parades, but I think gay pride has to begin within, you know. And
so, in other words, you were out of the closet before you genuinely felt okay with who you were.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And living as an openly gay man, but all of a sudden, I'm 42 years old, took away all my medicine, and I was riddled with internal homophobia.
Still.
Well, no, that was 10 years
ago.
No,
I mean, still at 42.
Oh, yeah, at 42, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. At 42, riddled. And in fact, my first counselor said, he said, you know, Leslie, you are sort of like a fag-hating fag. And I said, no, that's not true. I do not, no, I don't like effeminate homosexuals. And he said, hello. So,
and he sent you to hang out with a bunch of straight guys.
Yeah, he asked me to... he said, I want you to join an all-male recovery group, you know, like a stag recovery group. And I thought, so I went, you know, I was kind of at the point, you know, trying to get sober, you know, at 42, you're, thank goodness, you're willing, you know, to do whatever is asked of you. And so I went and joined, and you could have cut the testosterone with a knife. This was a group of guys, they didn't sing happy birthday for someone's sober birthday. They went, ooh, ooh, ooh. I mean, it was that sort of back slabbing, crotch grabbing, spitting on the floor kind of, this kind of masculinity that has just escaped me. I'm terrified of it. I'm real attracted to it. We won't go down that road. We'd never find our way back.
Hold on one second, because I want to get to there's a resolution to the story, okay. And we'll get that in just a minute. Leslie Jordan is my guest. He's an actor, and he will be in a one-man show about his memoir of the same title called My Trip Down the Pink Carpet. That takes place tomorrow night at the Majestic Theater in Dallas at 8. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Chris Boyd, you're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Emmy Award-winning actor and writer Leslie Jordan. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
So you're there in the stag recovery group, getting hooted every time that you've been another week sober.
Right. And I walked in, and I stood there, and my first thought was that I should have left my MERS, which is sort of a male
man purse.
In the car, I remember thinking, oh, gosh, here I am with this, you know, bag over my – I mean, straight guys carry bags, but there's something about the way a gay man carries their bag. But as if that's the only thing that would have given me away had I left my bag in the car, I would have fit right in. But I walked and I shook a lot in early sobriety. I think it has to do I'm very active in the rooms of recovery, and I think sometimes they don't talk enough about just getting physically sober, just mm-hmm. getting your blood sugar level back. But I shook, and I was like a little chihuahua sitting there with these big, straight, heterosexual men. And I tried every trick in the book. We went around the room to introduce ourselves, and I tried sort of, you know, lowering up. My name is Leslie, and I'm an alcoholic. They were on to me. So I – anyway, they asked near the end of the meeting, would I like – the new guy would like to share. And you had to walk up – to the podium, up some steps. It was a little podium that you shared from. And I'd heard a really funny story in my gay recovery group that week where this guy, he was very effeminate. He made me look like a Hell's Angel. he said that early in his sobriety, he had to share at an all-straight meeting. And he called his sponsor and he said, "Listen, do you think I should tell him I'm gay just right off the bat, you know?" And his sponsor said, "Honey, you got to walk to the podium." they're going to know. So that story was, you know, I was thinking, God is so – I'm going to try to not walk like – a friend of mine told me one time, he said, "Leslie, you walk like Bette Midler in concert." So I tried to kind of walk like John Wayne, and I made it to the podium. And I remember I stood there looking out over – what I thought of as the enemy, these guys, and something really cathartic happened. I somehow knew, especially concerning my sobriety, that this was the jumping off point. And it was like when I was a kid and I wanted to jump off the high board. And, you know, you just get – you get up there and you look down and you think, I can't jump, but what's the alternative? You have to make all the kids back down the ladder.
I'm really screaming at you and saying,
yes,
come on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I thought it's do or die. It's sink or swim. And I took a deep breath and I looked at him, and I think for the first time in my life I just told the truth. I said, "My name's Leslie. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also recovering – I'm a drug addict, but I think more important for me and my sobriety, I need to say this out loud. I am a homosexual." And there was like this – I was waiting for the one smart aleck, you know, to holler, "No." You know, but
– just be really careful with it.
So anyway, I laid it out. You know, I said, "I'm scared to death of you guys. Mm-hmm. I really am. I'm afraid that you're going to, you know, shun me. I'm afraid you're going to laugh at me behind my back. But most of all, I'm just afraid of you." And after that meeting, I was just enveloped with this unbelievable, unconditional love. You know, those men, it's so strange. I think that I'd been in some sort of holding pattern since my dad was killed in a plane crash when I was 11 for someone to kind of take up the slack and teach me like what it means to be a man, because I thought I would go to my grave a failure, because I thought to be a man had how much weight you can lift, how far you can throw a football, how many women you've bedded or something. And these guys taught me that it matters little that I never learned to walk or talk like a man, that you need a code in which to live your life by. And they gave me this amazing code that's sort of based upon the 12 steps of recovery. And as long as I remain true to that, you know, I'm a man. So
that's really interesting, because I guess, yeah, at 11, your image of what a man is, of course it's stunted. And of course it's sort of, you know, polarized. And you really don't understand that there's a spectrum for everyone.
Right. So it was, you know, one of the guys in the group had this card laminated, and he gave it to me, and he said, "I want you to carry this in your wallet, Leslie." And it said on the card, "What you think of me is none of my business." And I thought, you know, I've spent half my life worrying what everyone thinks about me, you know, instead of worrying what I think about me. So my journey into sobriety, which has been the last 10 years, has been this sort of amazing journey into my queerdom, where, I mean, especially the spiritual journey, which is the main reason that I wrote the book, was the beliefs that I was handed in the Baptist church as a kid were impenetrable, you know, early 10 years ago. And I've taken I'm really involved in this organization called the Trevor Project, and it's a suicidal hotline for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth.
Because they have the highest suicide rate, right, of anybody.
Three times more likely to commit suicide than their straight counterparts. When Trevor Project plugged in 10 years ago, within 3 months they had 15,000 calls of young men and women that were considering suicide. And most of those calls, gay men and women, most of those calls came from the Bible Belt. And that breaks my heart. In fact, when I sat down to write my memoir, I thought, you know, please, I'm not even on the D list with Kathy Griffin, you know. why would I? But I wrote it because of that. I thought, you know, my journey is, besides being, I mean, I do have a gift. I'm a good writer, and it's a funny journey, and there's lots of great stories. But I want that young gay man, that young gay woman in our hinterland or wherever, out. Because I read somewhere in a magazine, I love this, that there's two kinds of gay people in America today. There's the fabulous, and there's the fearful. And there's really no in between. Those of us who are in the big cities who have found our tribe and, as I say in the book, found our place on the pink carpet, because that's the metaphor there, we're the fabulous ones. But we really forget that still their kids just deathly afraid. I mean, they'll be thrown out of their family. You know, we have all kinds of housing now all over the place for kids that have been tossed out of their families. So I thought, you know, I want to write my story because I do believe that there's a God who loves me unconditionally. You know, I believe there's a God who looks down with fatherly pride upon his handiwork and rejoices that I am who I am and what I am. And what a, you know, what a difference from this, you know, guy who stepped off the bus in 82, sort of riddled with homophobia and with beliefs that were impenetrable from my Baptist upbringing.
You know, I think what's great about you telling your story is that a lot of people would look at you and assume that you've always been fabulous, that you never had, you know what I mean, that you never had issues or that you were always so out that, you know, there might be people who are gay that think, well, if I could be like that, then I'd be okay, but I have still this ambivalence. But what you reveal is that you can look that way to everybody else mm-hmm. and still be dealing with issues.
Yeah. And I have, you know, I learned when I was 17 years old, I started journaling obsessively. I don't know what that's about, but I, under my bed at my house in Los Angeles, I have journals where on a daily basis I wrote, I mean, you look back and you're mortified at, you know, but I have journals. I've journaled. And then somewhere along the way I realized, I think early in recovery especially, because the recovery movement is based upon sharing, that we're only as sick as our secrets. And if I read aloud to another person, whatever demon, you know, whatever, you know, when the scary monsters under the bed begin that low moan that I write, and then I read it aloud and it loses its power. And then somewhere along the line in early recovery, I figured out I could get on stage and tell these stories in a entertaining and lucrative, lucrative being the operative word, but I could, I have to tell you, I'm 53 years of age, and I am closer to my authentic self than I've ever been. I mean, I really am more comfortable in my skin and happier than I've ever been, and it wasn't always that way. And so this journey, you know, I put it down on paper, and we'll see.
So does that throw a layer of complication for you on the roles that you choose? Because now you've played a lot of gay characters, but now do you think, well, I don't want to do this joke because that one sort of plays into the stereotype that homophobes would cling to?
I'm going through this thing right now, which has been a real test. I got my dream job recently. It was Linda Bloodworth Thomason writing Lily Tomlin and a wonderful actress named Mary Kay Place. Mm-hmm. And it was a project called 12 Miles of Bad Road, and it took place here in Dallas. We were the richest people in Preston Hollow.
This for HBO?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And HBO. And we shot 6 episodes. I thought they were brilliant. We had to stop because of the strike. There was a huge change of regime at HBO. So when the strike was up, they shelved the project. Just, I mean, it we were just flabbergasted. And then I start hearing that one of the main problems was my character. They didn't think that my character was a good representation of the gay community. I played an aging, very wealthy homosexual who had a penchant for young, sort of rough hustler boys. So, but you know, my argument was why do I have to in my work be a good representation of the gay community?
The symbol of everything.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like the African American character in the 70s. I think gay characters are taking that same arc. In the 70s, all of a sudden, everybody wanted a black character, you know, like with the Archie Bunker show and everything. But it had to be politically correct. It couldn't be too street.
It couldn't have flaws. It had to be someone who was sort of making up for all the damage done.
And someone who looked white was what early on, you know, mm-hmm. the Lena Horns and the, you know, the Diane Carrolls. And then everybody wanted a black character, but it had to be politically correct. You know, couldn't yada yada. And, you know, now we're at the point where there's just black characters. There's good ones. There's bad ones. Who cares? You know, it's entertainment. It's part of the story. And that's the point we're at right now with the gay character is, like, I can remember when they first started allowing gay characters on television, what they wanted was Niles, who wasn't even a gay character, mm-hmm. off of Frasier.
Right, with a very sort of fussy, persnickety.
Very, mm-hmm. you know, urbane and witty. Right. And then I would come in, and I wasn't that at all. And they'd say, oh, well, no, he's not, you know, he's not gay enough, or he's not what we think of as gay. And I would say, it doesn't get any gayer. But anyway, it really hurt my feelings when I was told that, I mean, there were all kinds of rumors that HBO was sending spies in to make sure I didn't get too gay and sending spies in to make sure I didn't get too broad. And
what do you think too gay meant?
I don't know. I don't know. Because I thought I was doing some really subtle work. In fact, one of the directors came over to me and said, you know, why don't you take the queen bit down just a day? And I thought, I am not doing Queen. I'm doing Butch. I'm doing the Butchest I can do.
Yeah. What would your Butch sound like if somebody somehow now? I guess this doesn't happen now in your career, but if someone hired you and said, "We want you to just be straight guy," how different would you sound?
I don't think I could do it. Uh huh. You know, it's strange because I used to also be able to do that. Not only could I do that, I could also drop my accent. And I have worked so solid. I decided a long time ago, I'm never going to be Robert De Niro. I'm never going to be Meryl Streep. I'm never going to be that kind of actor that just loses, you know, that you just lose into the character. And quite frankly, I've never been asked to play a character I thought was more interesting than me in real life. So I've just done this sort of Leslie Jordan for so long. I have a funny story in the book where they hired me to be a Ferengi on Star Trek.
These are the guys with the weird teeth that kind of hang
down.
Yes,
and big ears. Yeah. And it was what it was 5 hours in the makeup chair with straws up your nose. It was awful. But, you know, the director was just relentless. He said, you know, this is not Deep South Nine. Because they have Deep Space Nine. He goes, this ain't Deep South Nine. Can you bring that Ferengi north of the Mason-Dixon? But I couldn't. And then he would say, for some reason, I would try to drop my Southern accent, and I fell into Cockney. So it was like Eliza Doolittle on crack. It was, but I don't know that I could play a perfectly straight character, and I've had enough exposure that I don't know that anybody would buy me as a.
That's not why they hire you.
Although I have to tell you, we finally get a gay sitcom, and my manager called up and said they want you for Ellen. They've written you in. They want you to play Jolie Fisher's boss, and I got the script, and I was like this little sort of womanizer, and I was supposed to walk in with two playmates. And, of course, I'm short, so there was the joke of me face-to-face with these enormous breasts was the jokes. But I thought, why would we we've worked so long to get this gay sitcom, and why am I going to have to play this straight man? I don't want to. But I thought I had pulled it off, and then I called a friend of mine who lives in the Midwest, and he said, oh, honey, I don't know. He said, I was watching it with some friends, and the minute you walked in, you know, with those two playmates – someone said, get a load of her. Herbie and me in the middle, not the playmates.
You know, I thought the sad thing about Ellen was that I think a lot of people were excited to see this character come out, and then it seemed like the sitcom lost a lot after she came out, even though a lot of people were rooting for her.
I know. But, you know, knowing the nature of the business, it's the same thing that we went through with Will and Grace. When a show is a hit, you have so many cooks in the kitchen all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. I mean, we would do table reads of Will and Grace where there would be 50 men in suits. Who are they? You know, they're the NBC execs. They're the, you know, the Warner Brothers execs or whoever the big producer. People. And they all have to put their input and they all have to kind of shove their weight around. And I would imagine that it reached a point where on Ellen, she's out now, but we can't let her be too out. You know, don't let her be too lesbian because we can't lose this. And then they stare at those numbers and it just becomes a nightmare, you know. So I don't know, you know. And like you said, in the midst of all that, the humor's lost. We used to go through that. Like when we were doing Will and Grace, we had a lot of you know, the gay people said it wasn't gay enough. And then the straight people said it was way too gay. And trying to find that balance and, you know, juggling those numbers, it was a nightmare.
Leslie Jordan is my guest. He is doing a one-man show at the Majestic tomorrow night at 8 called My Trip Down the Pink Carpet. He's also releasing a memoir of that title. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and actor Leslie Jordan. I want to talk a little bit more about Will and Grace because for better or for worse, it seems like for a lot of straight America that before was really homophobic, that show was their entree into gay culture. People who had never considered having a gay friend before, or maybe had one and didn't know it, suddenly learned about being gay from that show. Was that a problem?
You know, the journey that I noticed was when I first started on the show, which was about season 3, these guys would come up to me, these heterosexual guys, and they'd always say this, my girlfriend or my wife watches that show. You are so funny. By the end, you know, 8 years in, I had perfectly heterosexual men that would admit that they watched Will. They'd say, man, that show's funny. You are funny on that show. And I thought, you know, I thought that's progress because I've always thought there were two ways to combat homophobia. One is, as we talked about earlier, through humor. I learned that in Dodgeball and another way is to put a face on it. And I think America, for better or worse, welcomed these characters into their homes and we laughed and we loved and progress was made. You know, it was interesting to watch because you had two producers. You had Max Muchnick, who is gay, and David Cohen, who's straight. Now, they have written together for so many years. They're like this wonderful old married couple. And Max always thought it was getting too Republican. This show's getting too Republican. And then David always thought it's getting a little too gay here. But that was this sort of amazing balance. And they knew exactly what they were doing. Because, you know, people would come up to me in the gay community and they'd say, well, Will needs to kiss. Why has Will never kissed a man, you know, or why has he never had a boyfriend? And I thought, you know what, you don't just shove your way into people's homes and say, you know, we're here, we're queer, deal with it. That's not going to get us anywhere, you know. We eased our way in, you know, and like you said, I think we changed things. You know, that show was so groundbreaking. I won an Emmy for that. How's that for a good little segue into that? So I dropped that pearl. But I thought, you know, when I did get the Emmy nomination, I thought, you know what, I've done so many sitcoms over the years. I've done some good work. I could probably have been nominated for anything, but to have been nominated for this show, especially being an openly gay actor in Hollywood since, you know, forever, I was so honored, you know, that it was that show.
Do Do you still, you have some great stories in here about being really attracted to certain people that you've worked with. Do you still get starstruck even after all these years?
Oh, I am so starstruck. I have this theory that a lot of homosexual men my age, you know, in their 50s or whatever, we're kind of like high school cheerleaders stuck in old men's bodies because when I'm a high school cheerleader, when red-blooded heterosexual guys in junior high school were learning the fundamentals of dating and flirting and they were finding really healthy ways to deal with all that teenage angst, where were we? You know, I know where I was. I was locked within the confines of my big secret, and I would have fantasy crushes. You know, I would sit in my homeroom and create these angst-ridden, completely unrequited fantasy crushes with, you know, the quarterback of the football. Then I'd break up with him, and, oh, I'd go with this one. And I'm still like that, you know. I had a series with George Clooney long before he became famous. It was called Bodies of Evidence. I had a series with Mark Harmon for years before he got really famous. Billy Bob Thornton and I had a series in the 90s called Hearts of Fire. I lived across the street from Luke Perry, who was Dylan on 90210, for 3 years before he got 90210. He was laying concrete. I used to feed him Thanksgiving every year because he didn't have enough money to go home.
We should pause and say you didn't sleep with any of these guys.
No, I never, ever slept. But in my mind, and that's what I talk about in my book, I had these, oh, amazing, you know, romances with all my leading men completely in my head. But that I still do that, you know. I got the honor. It was such an honor of working with Helen Mirren about a month ago. And I didn't realize her husband is Taylor Hackford, who directed Officer and a Gentleman and Ray, lots of movies. And I auditioned for him for this small part in this movie. And he said, oh, I'd love for my wife to meet you. And I didn't put two and two together. He said, can you come back this afternoon at 5 o'clock and meet my wife? And so I went back at 5 o'clock and walked in. And here is Helen Mirren, not much taller than me, in this gypsy skirt, you know. And I was so flabbergasted. I just looked at her and said, well, you played the queen. I am an old queen. I said, we should get along wonderfully. But I got this huge crush. Her husband's like, Taylor Hackford is sort of my generation. He's my age. But he's this wonderful old deep-thinking sort of hippie, you know. And I had to admit to Dame Helen. Is she a dame yet? I don't know. There's Dame
she
Judith Dench.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
should be. But I leaned into Helen and I said, I don't know what we're going to do, but I have a huge crush on your husband. And she said, well, you know, you can have him. I've had him 20 years.
Well, do you think that's part of the reason why, and I realize I'm making a gross generalization here, but why, generally speaking, women are less likely to have issues with homophobia than men? Do you think it's because women relate to gay men in being attracted to men?
I think so. I also think it's just the way that men are raised in our country. There's something, I don't know. I used to envy the way in my junior high the girls could have slumber parties and roll each other's hair and giggle. And, you know, for instance, let's say that two girls maybe got a little inebriated one night and kissed, just joking or something. What would happen the next day? They would look at each other and just scream, oh, my God, can you believe it? If that happened just somehow between two guys, it would destroy their friendship. It would never be mentioned. There's some sort of, I don't know,
it's like
I don't,
a weird taboo.
Yeah, it's just so ingrained in men that, you know, we and I noticed I did a play called Southern Baptist Sissies, and I toured with Delta Burke, and we did it all over the country, and it was sort of wonderful. And I fussed at the director. I said, you have hired four straight men to play four gay men. And my friend Dale Shores, the director, said, well, you can't ask them. You know, you hire the best actor. And if they can play the best gay character, it doesn't matter whether they're gay, straight, or whatever, I can't ask them. But I watched this amazing thing happen where these four straight guys had to play gay characters, and two of them had to kiss on stage. Once they got past that, they were so hilarious the first time they had to do it, you know. I mean, just—
Was there a lot of, like, dude?
Yeah, dude. And then they would grab them, you know, talk, how about them dogs and whatever that sports talk is. And then But I watched this amazing friendship that once they got past that, whatever that is, that horrible thing that could possibly happen, they had the sweetest friendship, mm-hmm. the kindest friendship. They began to watch out for each other in different kind of ways. These are perfectly – one is married. His wife's pregnant now. The other one – these are not in any way homosexual men. You know, but because they got past that whatever that is, you know, that punch on the back, oh, come here, you know, they developed this friendship that I would get tears in my eyes. I would watch them, how kind they were to each other, how they watched out for each other. I don't know how we got on that, but
that's a good story. We have an email from Angela who says, I loved Sordid Lives and have all my friends watch it, straight or gay. Brother Boy will always be one of my favorite characters, and I can never eat enchiladas again without quoting you. She says, I'm so glad you've been open. I've been out since I was 14. She's 40 now, and I'm going through the 12 steps as we speak.
Wow. See, I love that. I love to hear that.
Do you ever – are there ever details of your life that you think, I can't believe I've put that in a book, or I've put that in a show, or I've now it's out there and I can't – there's no taking it back?
All the time. I wrote my mother a letter this morning, and my mom is very private. My mother will never be Betty DeGeneres. She'll never march in a parade with a sign that says, I'm the proud mother of a gay son. She's doing the best she can with the light she has to see with, and she adores me, but she doesn't – she said to me once – Leslie, if I live to be 105, I'll never understand this deep-seated need that you have to air your dirty laundry. Why can't you whisper it to a therapist? But I wrote her this letter, and I said, you know, Mom, I wrote this book because I want the young gay man, the young gay woman to know my journey. So I want you to read page 246 first, because that tells why, you know, why I wrote the book. I said, I want you to understand that sex sales, celebrity gossip sales, unburdening of one's soul sales. And I want us, you know, as a family, because we've been through so much I want to be really financially comfortable. You know, I want my mother to be able to go knowing her children are well taken care of. And we're close and we're in it all together. But I, you know, there are stuff that's just going to curl her hair. You know, I read it and I think, oh, my gosh, my mother will just especially the – but, you know, we're taught in recovery, we share about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And so that was basically the journey that I wrote about. But, of course, the press is going to pick up on what it was like, you know, mm-hmm. the funny stories, you know, of being a drunken, crazed, you know, person running around Hollywood. But
– they called you the Tiny Terror.
Oh, I know now because I have I'm hypoglycemic. I've been tested, borderline diabetic. But you know, you drink and alcohol turns straight to sugar. So I was happy, 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 and then I would turn on you like a mother-in-law. I mean, I would turn on you. My friend does this wonderful impersonation where I'm like woo woo, and then all of a sudden it's not always about you. And my friend would say, Leslie, why do we go through this every time you drink? I don't want to fight. This is not always about you. You know, just me. And I would slap people. Sometimes people whose faces I couldn't even reach. But it was the blood sugar. You know, I think back when I just have all this guilt and shame about how I behaved.
Do you ever miss a little bit of the way you were when you were drinking?
The only thing I think that I miss at all was it gave me kind of a fearlessness that I don't have now, you know. And also, as all alcoholics, I miss that way in which to just sort of take the edge off. Mm-hmm. You know, you've had a bad day. The problem with an alcoholic is that we have, you know, people think that alcoholism is how much you drink, how often you drink. None of that. Alcoholism is what happens to you when you drink, you know. And I was the kind that I took the drink and then I had no idea what would happen. It could be just one of those nights where it was a couple of drinks and, you know, I've never had one drink in my life ever. But, you know, a few drinks and go home. But then it's just like something clicks and you are off on that tear and there's no telling. I went to jail 5 times. And listen, when you're 4'11" and you're not exactly a pillar of masculinity, the jailhouse is not where you want to be. And so that's the main reason I got sober. I was just tired of going to jail. But I do miss that being able to just – my mother, I adore her, but my mother loves to – she'll say, well, you know, I have a little Calmative. Would you like to take – and I go, no, Mother, I can't take that. Well, you want half? I said, no, I can't take any of it. You know, she'll have a little half of her Calmative, you know, Mother's Little Helper.
So she won't drink, but she'll have a pill now.
Yeah.
Is there a dream role for you that hasn't been written yet, but that you sort of fantasize about when you're driving around and imagine playing this character?
I don't think so. The really cool part about where I am right now is that I mean, I have dreams. You know, I want to do Broadway. The one-man show that's going to be at the Majestic tomorrow night, I did it for the Harvey Milk High School, a big benefit in New York. It's a magnet school for kids that are, if they're teased and having trouble, they can go to an all-gay high school. I cannot even imagine the drama in an all-gay high school.
Well, they have prom and everything.
Oh, they have everything. Yeah. And they're wonderful kids. Mm-hmm. And I sobbed when I met them. I just sobbed. But I used Alec Mapp, a friend of mine, a comedian. I used my line. I said, well, we had a gay support group in my high school. It was called the Drama Club. But I did my show in New York, and as a surprise to me, they had Terrence McNally, who's my favorite playwright. But I peeped out the curtain, and I sort of freaked out because I said, no, you don't understand. This is not like a play. This is just to sell my book. This is like an industrial. I can't put this up in front of Terrence McNally. Are you kidding me? They said, Leslie, it's too late. So I went out, and Terrence McNally led the standing ovation. And afterwards, he gave a little speech and said, you know, we expected humor. We did not expect such generosity of spirit. And I've been invited to come to New York to do it. So
it's great. And you can see Leslie Jordan tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at the Majestic Theater performing his one-man stage show. It's called My Trip Down the Pink Carpet. The book comes out in June. Leslie, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Wow, an hour. We just chatted away. Thank you for having me.
Raced by. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.